Hi, I'm Paul Fine from Reason TV. We're at Reason's LA-based studios here. As some of you may have heard, the voters in Colorado and Washington legalized marijuana this past November. But that's not the end of the story. A lot of hard work is yet to be done. And we're going to talk about some of the implementation challenges for the folks in Colorado and Washington. I'm joined today by David Bienenstock. He's the editor, West Coast editor of High Times magazine. And he's also the author of a new book called Legalized It. We're also joined by Harris Kenny. He's a Reason policy analyst. And Harris is on the task force in Colorado to give recommendations about how to move forward with implementation. Welcome, guys. Thanks for being with us. And welcome to our studio audience today as well. The first question I have, and I'm going to direct this to you, Harris, why did the efforts in Colorado and Washington work? What were the strategies that were used, and what can y'all learn from the campaign successes that can inform the implementation efforts?
Well, I think the first thing to recognize is that there were years of marijuana reform election efforts, initiatives at the state and local level that laid the groundwork. And the biggest thing that was pointed to after this election in 2012 was the fact that the campaign really invested a lot of money in appealing to sort of the median voter. The campaign was tax and regulate marijuana. They focused a lot about controlling the black market, and they focused on arguments that convinced 55% of the voters, a majority of the voters, that this was the prudent direction to take it in. It wasn't a radical campaign. John Ingold for the Denver Post explained how they put on suits and ties and ran a traditional campaign to convince people, and I think that that's pretty widely accepted as a number of the reasons why they were successful.
And David, I'll ask you, you're in town. What brings you to LA?
Right now we're having an event in Los Angeles called the Medical Cannabis Cup, and I'm here in advance of that, and great. Also, of course, to speak with Reason.
And great, and there are going to be a lot of guys in suits and ties at the Cannabis Cup?
There will be a few. No doubt they might be from the BOE, but...
What do you think about that, dressing up in suits and ties and going out there to create change? Is that created contrast or tension with the other parts of the movement?
I mean, I think first of all, lots of people who wear suits and ties every day smoke marijuana, whether they want to work to legalize it or not. So, you know, we are representing who we are. We're a broad range of people. I think that in addition to what you said, what I think worked in Colorado and Washington is that familiarity with marijuana does not breed contempt. And that's whether you become a user of it or you just know that your neighbor is using it. And we've seen in Colorado and Washington through medical marijuana and through these long-running campaigns, the more people become familiar with marijuana and marijuana users, the more comfortable they become. And to ask voters in a state like Colorado that has state-regulated medical marijuana retail outlets to envision a world where now any adult can go into that same retail environment, it's just not such a leap. And I think, you know, one of the best arguments going forward is the people who are most familiar with marijuana and especially retail sales of marijuana are the ones who legalized first.
Absolutely. Next question I have is, you know, are Colorado and Washington State going to turn into the next Amsterdam? Are there going to be coffee shops there? Is there going to be pot tourism? What do you guys make of, we'll point this to David.
It's no surprise that I hope so. You know, Amsterdam is a wonderful city, so there's certainly nothing wrong with emulating them. I think that if you're going to say something is legal, and that's what the voters said in overwhelming numbers, then you have to treat it like something that's legal. You have to treat marijuana like alcohol and not like plutonium. And, you know, particularly in Colorado, the messaging was, let's treat marijuana like alcohol. Well, I can go into a bar, I can go into a liquor store, I can have people over in my home, and we can have the Great American Beer Festival in Denver where thousands of people gather to responsibly enjoy alcohol. And I personally don't see anything that says marijuana should be different.
Great, so what do you think about that, Harris?
Well, the question, unfortunately, even though it seems like the intention of voters was clear, the intention of the elected officials, regulators, and other people involved in implementing don't necessarily share that vision right away. And so a couple big questions need to be asked. The first one is, can someone that's not from Colorado or Washington, from another state or country, purchase marijuana? And it appears that in both states that's going to be the case, which is a big step. Another important question is, how are they going to handle diversion? So what sort of regulatory regime and enforcement is going to be put in place to prevent marijuana that's legally purchased from going out of state in particular? And so those regulatory questions and questions about cafes and things like that, the answers are not immediately clear. In Colorado, there's a Clean Indoor Air Act, which prevents smoking indoors, that was amended for medical marijuana and will probably be amended for marijuana as well. But that doesn't mean that other ways to consume cannabis won't be allowed on site, on business sites. And there's a lot of discussion about private clubs in private residences and things like that. And so unfortunately, we don't know yet, but I think the intention is to regulate like alcohol, and I think the intention is going to be to try to get as close as we can to that, with the exception of the fact that Colorado actually has a really bad regulatory system for alcohol, so we don't want to copy it exactly verbatim. We want to hopefully learn from some of the mistakes there, and then one day we will run a campaign to regulate alcohol like marijuana, and we will reform the alcohol prohibition or regulations.
Or it might turn out to be something like what's happening in Amsterdam now, where you can smoke your marijuana in the coffee shops and spliffs, so pot and marijuana mixed, but you can't smoke cigarettes inside. You have to go outside to smoke your cigarettes. That's a reasonable model. That's something we can aspire to, I think. What about some of the other legal ramifications? You're not going to be busted for smoking pot or selling pot in these two states, David. But what about other? Are there other legal ramifications if people are, you know, smoking pot?
Yeah, there certainly are, and we really have to be careful that we don't create second-class citizens when we legalize, and that's anything from, can you be fired from your job for using legal marijuana? Can Child Protective Services come into your family life and make irrevocable decisions based on benign marijuana use? Can you be denied a student loan to go to college? And that's, of course, if you're 21 or older even. Can you get a loan for your business if it's a marijuana-related business? To me, legal means I can do something and there's not irrevocable ramifications to it. You know, if you can't drive a car, if you can't work your job, if you can't bank, if you can't raise your kids in a responsible way, it's not legal. And what people said is, we want this to be legal. And so I'm hopeful that this kind of thinking is recognized in the implementation process.
Yeah, what are you guys talking about in Colorado with respect to these kinds of legal ramifications?
Well, there's a lot of change that needs to be happening. And unfortunately, you know, one thing that activists and people that support marijuana reform are upset about is that employers do have a right to terminate at this point, and likely will, someone for consuming marijuana if that's against their employment rules or labor rules. And in the campaign, in Amendment 64 was fairly comprehensive. It was a lot more, it opened up the doors to a lot more things than Washington State did. They did preserve that right, and they separate medical and recreational. I think the big takeaway first is that the civil liberty protections to possess marijuana and consume marijuana in your home and for adults 21 and over, and the civil liberty protections that are going to reduce prison populations and get rid of the major costs are in place. And some of these other still serious costs are going to take time. There's going to be cultural change. Employers are going to change their hiring practices. Communities are going to become more sensitive. But I think the big issues have been taken off the table, which is incarceration and things like that. And it's going to take some time for these other still important issues to get hammered out. It's going to take, I think, a number of years.
One of the other big questions people in Washington State are looking at is, how do you deal with DUI related to marijuana? Because that was built in to their ballot initiative, or ballot measure. What do you guys think about that? What kinds of conversations have you had with people in Washington? Is that something that's going to be a viable way to keep, you know, people who are too high off the roads? Or what do you think about that?
I mean, first of all, I think that's not only a valid concern, the most valid concern moving forward. You know, just as I feel I have a right to use marijuana responsibly, I recognize that everyone has a right to be on the roads safely. If you're impaired on any substance, you should not be behind the wheel. What's somewhat difficult with marijuana is determining what impairment means can be difficult, and it's tempting to say, well, let's just draw this hard line. But if you're putting people in a situation where they smoked a joint legally 3 weeks ago, but they're subject to a DUI every time they get behind the car during those 3 weeks, that's not fair, that's not legal. And my big concern, as I said, familiarity with marijuana is what's moving this forward. It makes it hard for that level of society that people really respect to admit that they use marijuana, because there's all these negative consequences waiting for you that might not be the criminal justice system. Well, in a DUI it is. But so, you know, there's ways to look at active amounts of THC in the bloodstream as opposed to just the presence of THC. I know there's a lot of efforts to work that out. I'm sure how it's coming together, you can talk more about that.
Yeah, what's happening in Colorado with that?
Sure, so in Washington's initiative, first it was in the initiative, and so it said there's a 5 nanogram of THC per milliliter of blood immediately in there. In Amendment 64 in Colorado, that was not included, but it did state clearly that you're not allowed to drive under the influence, which is already illegal, it's still illegal. That said, over the last 3 years, the legislature has tried to pass a DUID, driving under the influence of drugs, bill, and it has failed because of the fact that it would be through a blood test. And there's, again, civil liberty concerns there. And law enforcement has concerns about their liability and whether or not they can be taking roadside blood tests. Would they need to take people into the sheriff's office or police department to do the tests and things like that? I think the long-term answer for this is going to be entrepreneurship. I think it's going to be somebody that invents a non-invasive saliva test, something that works. And I hope they make a lot of money. And entrepreneurs, if you're watching this, start entrepreneuring, get inventing, talk to engineers. I think that's going to be the long-term solution. And I think anything in the short term is going to be an attempt. We'll see. You know, I think the biggest thing with these DUID bills is the ability to challenge in court. So it shouldn't be assumed automatically if you have a certain level of THC in your system that you're impaired. And I think that's a workable compromise that everybody can agree on moving forward. And so hopefully that'll be a feature in all of these DUID legislation or regulation rules, things like that.
Great. Now, as the sort of political battle moves forward, what's your sense right now of who the friends of the movement are and who the foes are? David?
I mean, I think that both campaigns did an excellent job of bringing a really broad coalition. You know, in Washington State, you had a former U.S. attorney, you had the mayor of Seattle, city attorney of Seattle, and then, you know, as far as from the High Times end of things, we, the people who enjoy marijuana have been pushing this issue in a very grassroots way for 30 years, and for someone who's been at this for 10 years, to see the corporate media, I'll use the term, starting to at least get this and report it in a responsible way has been great and has been a big part of moving this forward. I think that every time somebody's aunt smokes a joint and their chemotherapy side effects go away, we gain 5 allies, because it's not just that person, it's everyone in their family that's touched by that. And no one ever goes back. I've never heard somebody say, well, you know, this really helped grandpa in his last years of life, but fuck everybody else. You know, it should still be illegal, but wow, what a miraculous plant, but fuck them. I've never heard that. So from friends, we are gaining every day. For foes, it's still the same people. People who make money off of incarcerating marijuana smokers in a variety of ways. You talked about entrepreneurs in the drug test industry, but obviously they're, you know, prison guards. Follow the money. If you make money off of incarcerating people for marijuana, you are in favor of the status quo. And I don't see too many people outside of that who still are.
Well, I should ask you as well. I mean, back in 2010, when Californians were excited about a failed ballot measure.
Well, we were excited about it when we thought it was going to pass.
Well, yeah, that's right. Right. And we're less excited about it now, and then people in Colorado have outpaced us. But, you know, one of the things that happened were a bunch of growers that had sort of locked in. They had market share. They came down to Oakland or walking around with no on Prop 19. Did you meet those folks? Did you talk to them? And what was your take from, are they rent-seeking bastards, or how do you think about it?
I think it's a complicated issue. One thing I want to stress to people in future initiatives is it's one person, one vote, not one plant one vote. So just because somebody grows, 200,000 plants, they still only get to vote once. And the population of Humboldt and Trinity County and Mendocino County is not large enough. That's the Emerald Triangle. That's where the large outdoor grows are. I'm not giving a big secret away. I think you have two things. You have people who have been living an outlaw lifestyle for generations, providing a plant to people that they really want, supporting their families, supporting their communities. The largest economic activity up there is marijuana production. And that's whether you own the hardware store, the pizzeria, the boutique, whether you want to go to a school up there that has a good tax base for running programs. So to say now, hey, thanks for growing our marijuana for three generations while helicopters flew over your house, but now we're going to legalize it so we have no, F you, I'm not with that. But also people have to recognize what keeps the prices up, and that's what they're worried about, is people getting busted. That's the prohibition tax. And so in one way, you had a small group of people who were very vocal and had a news story that potheads against legalization, that's a story. Even if it's 10 people with no support out ranting in the streets, So I think it got overblown in a lot of ways. I think in my position for the last 10 years, I've dealt with nothing but people who grow marijuana or are very tied into this culture. And the people I have met who are not 100% supportive of marijuana legalization is a very, very small number, and it was disproportionately covered in the media.
Great. Well, that's good to hear in lots of ways. And Harris, what do you think? Friends and foes in Colorado?
Well, one of the most interesting aspects of the implementation in Colorado is, and this may offend libertarian sentiments, but the regulators and bureaucrats have been some of the best advocates for a functional, competitive system. And that's the folks at the Department of Revenue. And they're doing a great job in the public hearing process throughout the task force meetings, basically laying out what they think is important and why they think a functional industry is the best for them. And I think it's good. Basically, their incentives align with a productive industry that generates a lot of money, that pays them application fees and pays tax revenue to them to promote and allow them to continue to do their activity. They don't want a fledgling, tiny, gray market, pseudo-illegal business that they can't make any revenue off of. And so because of that, they've been really pushing back on some of the bad ideas that would limit the ability of businesses to operate and grow. And then they've been supporting some of the good ones. And so that, I think, is one of the most interesting stories. And to their credit, the Medical Marijuana Enforcement Division, I don't dish out praise a lot for public agencies, so I really want to be on the record. I think they're doing a great job. And so that's one of the big ones. I think another friend to think about is going to be the press corps. The Denver press corps, folks with the Associated Press, the Denver Post, Westword, which is an alternative, locally circulated paper, they're doing a pretty good job, I think, handling it responsibly and treating this like a policy issue, which is what it is. And I think that combination of things is allowing Colorado to move forward, and I'm very optimistic. Things are going well as far as treating this like a serious issue, which it is.
And what about the existing medical marijuana dispensary owners in Colorado? Are they getting behind it, or what's their role going forward? And you should talk a little bit, maybe give some background about who gets the priority when it goes retail eventually.
Sure. So that's definitely a huge aspect of it. So in Amendment 64, it's really clear that the medical and recreational industries are separate, but it's unavoidable that the existing medical industry, growers, retailers, MIP, so the ingestible product companies, and testing companies and things like that, have a seat at the table. They're the ones that deal with the Department of Revenue right now. And they've, like Dave was saying, they've risked a lot to operate under violation of federal law. And so they deserve credit for that. And the Amendment 64, the language does say that they get a priority or preference when applying for recreational licenses as well. And so there's a few structural things where they deserve, it's important to see where they're special or how they're unique. But there are aspects of the system today that they would benefit from, or that many of these businesses would benefit from, if it were to continue. And one of these is vertical integration. And so the idea is 70% of the plants that are sold in a retail location have to be grown by that same business owner, business operator. And then 30% can be wholesaled in the wholesale market. And there are some strong advocates in the industry arguing to retain vertical integration, arguing against allowing out-of-state investors to be owners, equity holders in marijuana businesses. And these are the sort of protectionist policies that would allow existing businesses to stay in place. And if these policies aren't allowed indefinitely, they may be allowed in a sunset format to allow a transition. And so that's definitely a big challenge. Medical industry doesn't necessarily have the same goals as a drug policy reformer, as an activist, as an attorney that works in the industry. There's sort of a shared end state, but some of the in-between steps are definitely going to be different. And so it's not a single monolithic movement of drug policy reformers.
Great. And then the last question I have, and this is a question that I think looms over all discussions about legalization, and that's the feds. You know, over time, are the feds going to be a friend or foe to the implementation process? What's your best guess?
Friend. No. I personally have been pretty encouraged by what I've seen since the election, and I think the most encouraging part is I think that they're finally afraid of us. And by they, I mean the federal government, and us, I mean the broad base of support for marijuana legalization. We had a source within the administration pretty much admit, well, the reason we didn't get involved in trying to stop this law in Colorado is we thought it would hurt our reelection chances. If you look at the votes cast total in Colorado and Washington, marijuana legalization outperformed the president. So, you know, on what basis are you going to come in and do these things and try? You know, I think that the federal government, I will say I'm pro-cannabis. I understand also some people say, well, let's limit the harms of these laws. They're my allies. But I think it's a good thing. Not for every person and not all the time, but I think society will be a better place. But I recognize the federal government has a responsibility to stop interstate traffic at this point. No one in Oklahoma said, we want to legalize marijuana yet. Well, some people did, but not enough. That's reasonable. But to come into a state or to say, I cannot go into Colorado and have the same rights as a Coloradan, right? Yeah. That to me is ridiculous. And I've been encouraged by the non-response of the federal government at this point.
Great. Are you equally optimistic, Harris?
I am. I will say maybe the federal government would be a frenemy, right? So they're friendly, but maybe also enemies. I'll say one quick thing. The only clear thing that I've heard that would say that would definitely cause the federal government to get involved would be if either Colorado or Washington were to set up state-run marijuana stores, like you have in a lot of states where you have state-run liquor or alcohol retail stores or wholesaling. And Dr. Sam Kamen, who's a law professor at the University of Denver, who's also on the larger task force, he's basically said that that's the only thing that he can think of from a legal perspective that would guarantee the federal government would come in. Because states would, I mean, it would be like if states were gun trafficking or, it's almost implausible. Some people have made the argument that they should do that, and I'm skeptical of the motivations for that argument. It seems like that would be trying to set these legalizing states up to fail. And it would be almost necessitating for the federal government to shut it down. So that's the only scenario I can think of where there's definitely going to be a problem. Other than that, it's wait and see.
So I hope you're listening, feds. Thanks, everybody. Thanks to David. Thanks to Harris. And thanks for the audience. It's great to have you here. These guys, well done.